From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? Joining me this week for our regular Goal Own Goal segment is the one, the only, thank the Lord, Roger Mitchell.
Hi, Grant. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm curious to understand how you're dealing with the quarantine, the dystopian quarantine where you are.
Dystopian quarantine. Yeah, I find myself back in the Cayman Islands wearing a tracker on my wrist, which attaches to a phone, which pings the government every, I don't know how often, to make sure that I don't leave the condo, basically. So I am here. I've had people knock on the door to check I'm all right, check I'm still here, check I haven't left. When the phone loses signal, they ring you and go, "Are you there? We've lost the signal to the phone." I mean, it's quite something. But once I'm out, hopefully on Friday of this week, there are no restrictions here. There's no COVID. So there's, you know, no masks, no social distancing, none of that stuff. So, you know, hopefully after the 2 weeks, if my sanity's still intact, it will have been worth it.
Geez, that sounds really extreme. It does play into the whole spy thing, doesn't it? Let's be honest.
Yeah. What kind of spy would I be, Rog? I mean, there's not much I can spy on around here, mate. I've got to be honest with you.
Yeah, but you're like kind of like moment where they're putting you under assessment again and you have to be like control, a little bit like that. You know, what was it, the Skyfall film at the start where Bond's not so good?
Oh, you think?
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
I think the worst thing you and I could ever do is play the word association game. we'd be off the air in 3 seconds. Anyway, listen, enough of that. We have the business at hand to get to, which is Goal on Goal. And, you know, normally I'm fairly
unrestricted in my... I think before we start, we need to make a couple of things that make a couple of comments before we get into Goal on Goal, because there's too many this week.
So, well, I just figured it would run long, but go on then.
Well, no, I just think before getting into the whole format of it, we should congratulate Nadal on the French
Open. Wait, how do you know that isn't one of my goals?
Well, if it is, we can play into it now. Is that one of your goals?
Yes.
All right. Okay.
Well, you see what you did there? By butting in, you've ruined the whole flow.
No, we've not.
Everything's ruined. That's it. I'm leaving.
Right.
So, I'm leaving.
So tell us about your goal, Nadal.
So do you know what? I saw not only the fact that you pulled, there were so many great things about this yesterday, this French Open.
Yeah.
Not only did you pull level with Federer on 20 slams. Grand Slams, which is exceptional, 13 of them at Roland Garros, which is
astonishing,
unbelievable. I remember the fuss made when Bjorn Borg won 5 Wimbledons, remember? And then it took all that time until Sampras beat him. But the demolition job he did on Djokovic yesterday, if you look at the scoreline, 6-love, 6-2, 7-5, was totally misrepresentative of the quality of the tennis. I mean, the first set was absolutely extraordinarily high level of tennis. I mean, how he won that 6-love, you know, it could have been 6-love the other way. That they were so evenly matched, I thought, throughout that set. But to see him win that, see him win it the way he did, to beat the guy he beat, but then the crowning glory for me was a tweet that Federer sent last night, you know, congratulating Nadal, a picture of the two of them, you know, saying how much respect he had for him, what a great competitor, what a great friend he was. Just class from Nadal. Djokovic was a good loser, class from Federer. It was just, you know, when you look at the three of these guys, 20 majors, 20 Grand Slams for Rafa, 20 for Federer, and I think 17. Djokovic is on 17.
Yeah.
I mean, 57 Grand Slams between those three guys. I mean, just think about those numbers, Roger. It's bewildering. And we've said this before. We've had this similar conversation about how we're undoubtedly reaching the end of the era of the big three, which is a shame. And there are people that hate the fact that they divvy these things up between them, but boy, are we going to miss them when they're gone, these three. But I just thought it was a wonderful day yesterday. And so Federer's tweet put the cherry on the cake for me.
Yeah. You know, I'm a big fan of Nadal, and I think those two finals, I think they were consecutive against Federer at Wimbledon. I'm talking about Wimbledon.
Yeah.
The first one he lost and the second one he won. Considering that grass isn't his surface, I thought that's the greatest tennis I've ever seen. And you know, Nadal takes huge credit for, you know, going into Federer's patch, if you will, and outplaying him really technically. What I would want to ask, because, you know, we tend to kind of try and look at the other perspective of things. 2017. Do you think, and shoot me down if you don't like this kind of like segue, but do you think the sniff of and performance enhancing from Nadal is going to linger when they look at the history books around this chap?
I doubt it. I doubt it very much for the big reason that it hasn't been. Look at the other people in recent times who've had the sniff around them, right? You've had Armstrong, obviously. We know what happened there. You had in baseball, you had the Barry Bonds, you had the Mark McGuire's, the Sammy Sosa's. We know what happened there. But at the time it was a big deal, it was everywhere. And you couldn't get away from it. And Nadal, there's been a little bit of a whiff here, there's been a little bit of a whiff there. And it never seems to have stuck to him. So I don't know. I really don't know. The fanboy in me just hopes it's all nonsense and hopes it goes away. For me, I've not seen enough. Armstrong, I was always suspicious. Bonds, I was always suspicious. McGuire, I was always suspicious. But Nadal's basically been at the same level since he was a kid. It's not like he's suddenly made huge leaps in his ability like the baseball players in particular did, and like Armstrong did. So for me, it won't be tainted. For me, there's certainly not enough of it to suggest it's a reality. And as I said, I really hope it isn't. Mm.
I just think, you know, if you remember our podcast with Duncan Castles and, you know, the name Fuentes and the whole Spanish sport thing and the list of athletes that never came out, that list of names.
No.
He was rumored to be on it. But, you know, you mentioned cycling and, you know, again, this isn't one of my goals because I'm not going to waste them. But, you know, there's a couple of things I want to tell you about this week. Are you following this trial of Dr. Freeman, the guy that was involved with Sky, the Sky cycling team and the doping and consigning? Are you following that at all, Grant?
I haven't been, no.
Well, we've got to be grateful to our mutual friend, Dominic Henderson, who keeps me informed. And as I want to read you a couple of things from the reporting this week, because he was on trial, Dr. Freeman.
Dominic's a hell of a cyclist himself, you know. King of the downhill.
So listen. He is getting cross-examined by, you can imagine, some of these super smart, you know, British QCs and things like that. And the article says, Dr. Freeman denies the key accusation, saying he was bullied into ordering the drug by former British cycling and Team Sky performance director Shane Sutton to treat his erectile dysfunction. So that is his line on trial to defend himself, and you know.
Well, Reg, I've got to say, if the drugs in question have that effect, this is a nightmare for a cyclist. Let's be honest.
Yes, it gets worse because obviously the smoking gun would be his laptop, right? That would have all this stuff on
it. An ironic choice of phrase, Rog, but okay.
So listen, this laptop has been damaged and can't be accessed, and the QC's, you know, having a go at him again. The lawyer said on Wednesday, quotes, "You've taken a screwdriver or some other blunt instrument to it, haven't you?" Friedman replied, "Yes, I have. Yes, I have." Yeah, he admitted it. Then he goes on, he said, "I had seen a program about how people in India can access data on laptops." He said, "I decided I cannot let this happen, so I destroyed it."
Okay.
This is a trial in the fucking High Court or whatever it is. I'm just thinking, Grant, that the world is going fucking erectile dysfunction. And he says, I understand you can access my computer for India, so I'll just fucking trash it. It goes on. Because then there's a famous meeting with James Murdoch where he was called to explain things. He says, I went down to see James Murdoch and Team Sky with Mr. Eastwood to be briefed at an imposing building at Canary Wharf. Mike Morgan was there, who is a big person in sports law, and Rupert Murdoch's lawyer was over from Australia. It was very tense, pressurised. They wanted to know how I would answer certain questions, clearly hoping that he wasn't going to go down the India data access. You know, like, they were trying to fucking prep him. Like, he says, I broke down in tears and I couldn't go on. Mr. Eastwood stopped the session. I never went back. I wrote to Damien Collins, Member of Parliament, to say I would answer questions in writing. You should have kept with that line.
Yeah, right. Well, now you've given me something else to watch. Thank God I'm locked down, Roger. I can catch up on all this now.
Absolutely. I mean, like, honestly, Grant, you know, and this is going to be a little bit the theme of my, own goal this week, but the world is going mad. Another one you probably haven't run into. You may be aware of the fact that Juventus were interested in Suarez, you know, the Barcelona player.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know... because that's the way it is, given he's from Uruguay, he's not EU, so there's work permits, playing permits, all the things you have to do. And the way around that was that he was going to become an Italian naturalized citizen. Don't ask the detail, it's not important. The fact is that in the beautifully Italian way, they were going to get him to pass the proficiency in the Italian language test. And right, you know, like, I don't know how this happens, but they've got transcripts of the telephone conversations from the university people that had to assess them. It's in Italian, so it doesn't translate that well, but honestly, it's more or less along the lines of, this fucker can't speak a word, but like, we have to pass him. He's on a 10 million a year salary, and it's Juventus, and like, it is the story of the week over here. Just like how you just, there's a rule, you just get round it. It's beautiful, Grant. It's beautiful.
Wait, hang on. So let me get this right, Rog. Italians in skirting the rules shock. Is that yes. is that basically yes. the headlines
yes.
here?
Yes. Yeah, but right. It's the imagination. Okay. There's nobody does it like the Italians. He's not got a permit. No problem. No problem at all. Before we leave this little pre-segment, I want to ask you another thing. Have you heard the name Pippa York? Do you know who Pippa York is? If you do that's mega points.
I did. Yes, I did. I'm worried where you're going with this, but yes, I did. Carry on.
Well, you know that in a previous life, Pippa York was that wonderful Scottish cyclist called Robert Miller.
Who yes, indeed.
Was a wonderful cyclist, King of the Mountains.
Fantastic, yep.
King of the Mountains. Well, he now goes by the name of, she goes by the name of Pippa York. And I'm not going to go any further with this because Pippa is now a black belt in Taekwondo.
You say now?
Yeah. She is now a black belt in the martial arts.
Okay.
So, like, well... You know, but the point of this is coming up is that there's this wonderful interview between Pippa and Bradley Wiggins, who obviously has got a lot to say about all this drug stuff, and he's in the middle of it. And You just look at this whole world. So that's why I started with the whole Nadal thing. Just look at this whole world, and you take a step back, and you think we're spinning out of control here. You know, not because she's transgender or anything like that. But I'm just saying, everywhere you look, there is absurdity. You know, like, let me throw another one at you. You know, bull riding, you know that's an up-and-coming sport. You know, Grant, did you know that?
I thought that was your porn name, but carry on.
Bull riding, you know, to get around COVID, you know where the next event is?
No, go on.
USS Lexington. An aircraft carrier.
Are you serious?
Yeah. here's the quote. We are excited to partner with the Bull Riding Federation and the USS Lexington on this special event, said Dan Weinberg, EVP programming CBS Sports.
Well,
it's unbelievable.
Well, look, one man's, everyone's losing their mind, is another man's, look how creative people are. I tend to side with you, to be honest with you, because there's so many more signs than just this. But it's, what a time to be alive, Rog. What a time to be alive. I tell you.
What a time to be alive. I mean, like, you know, I'm just picking up another one here. Casually, as you go through your timeline, Wigan's new owner is the nephew of a lion tamer. He's the new owner of Wigan. Why would he not be the nephew of a lion tamer?
You know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of Walker and Wise when he'd sit there when Ernie was trying to write and Eric would have the newspaper and he'd read out all these random headlines, right? They were all just gangs.
I've got another one for you. You know, you're following the Wrexham story, aren't you, with Ryan
yes.
Reynolds, right?
Yeah.
Well, nobody has got them to say why they're interested particularly in Wrexham. You know, there's a director or a screenwriting partner, the guy Rob McClennelly. I don't know how you pronounce that.
Yeah.
So the speculation is, and I think it's been confirmed by insiders, that his grandfather was a miner. So that's why he likes Wrexham. And Russell Reynolds' ancestor was a long oarsman.
Was it what?
Long oarsman. You know, like when you're letting the boat, you know, like this, you're rowing.
I'm still not quite sure why that makes me want to buy Wrexham.
But well, I mean, is that not a fishing town? Is Wrexham not a fishing town?
Yeah, possibly. Possibly. But I would think if you just wanted to go back to the sea, there are better ways to doing it than buying Wrexham.
Yeah, but these days, they're like, why not is the phrase, why not?
And well, like, yeah, there is that.
Why not?
There's a touch of what the why nots to it. Well, look, I'll tell you what, I'm gonna kick off the show proper with a goal, seeing as there are so many potential own goals here. And obviously, I've steered well clear of the thing that I know you're going to want to talk about. So if you end up not choosing that, I will, but the chances are very slim. But I'm gonna kick off with the Bledisloe Cup yesterday. Australia-New Zealand Rugby Union, which is always just a fantastic spectacle. It's always a hugely keenly contested contest. And even though the Aussies haven't won the Bledisloe Cup for 18 years, the games are always, always close. They give New Zealand a run for their money just about every time. And yesterday was no exception. Now, this is a brand new Aussie team with a new coach, massive underdogs. And they ended up getting a tie, 16-all.
Yeah.
But O'Connor had a kick from 57 metres. With time expired, and he hit the upright and didn't knock it over. Now, the amazing thing was from 57 metres, he was about a foot from the top of the upright, which is an extraordinary kick.
Yeah.
The siren had gone. So basically, for those of you who don't follow rugby, once the siren goes at 80 minutes, the next time the ball's out of play, the game is dead. Game finishes. The Aussies eventually kicked the ball into touch after 89 minutes. So with time expired, both teams spent another 9 minutes desperate to get the win, which is fantastic in itself. But, you know, for me, a couple of things. One, it was so good to see sport in a stadium filled with fans down in Wellington.
Yeah.
You really do realise what an element that takes away, not having the fans there. It was fabulous to see. You know, after Michael Hooper, the Aussie captain, it was his 100th cap. And just the All Blacks sent out a bunch of tweets, which if you're interested in this at all, just go to the All Blacks tweet timeline and you'll see all these clips, of both of the highlights, but also behind-the-scenes stuff of the Kiwis congratulating Hooper on his 100th cap, giving him a bottle of wine. That spirit, that camaraderie, that level of intensity on the field, but brotherhood off the field is something that I won't say it's unique to rugby, but it's certainly one of the things that to me, and I grew up playing rugby as very much my second sport. I was a footballer first and foremost. I just think these days I would much rather watch rugby than football. And it almost breaks my heart to say it.
Is that right?
But there's so much, yeah, there's so much good about rugby union at that elite level. I'm talking about international tier, Roger.
Yeah.
I'm talking about, which was contrasted with the England-Belgium game yesterday. Yes, England beat Belgium 2-1 in a, averagely interesting game with no fans, plenty of diving, a lot of sort of exaggeration shouting at the ref. And it just brought the contrast home to me. So I thought the Bledisloe yesterday was just fabulous theatre and so much good about everything we love about sport.
Nice one. Very nice one. I did see something in the dressing room afterwards that they were kind of like congratulating each other or something. It looked nice. It looked nice.
Yeah.
What I would say, and this will segue probably into something that we can't avoid talking about. What I will say is that when I joined the sports industry just a bit over 20 years ago, and you come in a bit like yourself, I'm like you, I'm multi-sport, I like watching everything, depends the time of the year. But somebody said to me, I can't remember who it was, they said, look, Rog, let's just get something clear. The sports industry is football, 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 and then maybe a couple of other things down the line that we keep the middle classes happy with, All of these things that you're saying are nice and lovely and they've got their place, but association football is where it matters, where people get excited, things that will make a government fall. And I think that is being seen all over the place now, and it leads into what I'm trying to pick out of positive, which I'm sure we'll get into a whole lot of negatives this week. I saw a tweet from your friend, Josh Wolfe, the VC guy, talking about our other friend, Jerry Cardinale's Redbird.
Yeah, Redbird, yep.
Doing the deal with Fenway Group. And, Josh, incredibly intimidating intellect, super, super smart guy, understands all about product market fit. Gets it completely. And, he was congratulating the deal and the idea of the deal. And he had this comment that I noted down because it was Josh and I parked it away a little bit. He's saying that all of these super clubs, what I like to call the Hollywood clubs, are really basically mini Disneys. They're now entertainment companies. They're content companies. And they have to be managed with the same look to IP, to, multiple revenue streams and everything like that. And, most of the rest of this podcast will probably be about all the distasteful stuff that's come out and people that don't like it. But, my view, Grant, and this is why this is, I guess, my goal before we go into the other side of the coin, is that... it's what I said, football is really important. And these are brands that affect people's lives. Jerry Cardinale knows that, did his SPAC, probably will do the Fenway Group's not completed yet. Remember the Fenway Group, John Henry, the famous scene in Moneyball. Anybody who's not taking their organization and reorganizing around your methods will not be around. This is all about a lesson in Darwinism, which is not the survival of the fittest, the survival of those that adapt most quickly. And Josh gets it because I think what he's alluding to, which is what I've always alluded to, is the current product doesn't fit with the current market. You can articulate that in a completely different way. You can criticize it. But the fact is that for the audiences that are here today and the ones that are coming, the current league structures and the governance and the way football is presented and organized, you mentioned a Belgian-England game that should be the top of the tree, but it isn't anymore. It needs to change. So, that's my goal, because you've got smart people like Cardinale, commented on by people like Josh Wolfe, that are saying, let's embrace change, Grant.
Yeah, look, Roger, I mean, your point about football being the most important. I mean, I get that. It's grassroots. It has that mass appeal. I wasn't talking about it in any other terms other than being a pure fan of sport and the theatre of sport. You know, angry rugby fans are not going to topple governments. You're absolutely right. But I was talking more about
just
the theatre. But yeah, look, I mean, Josh is an incredibly smart guy, and that story, I steered clear of that because I figured that would be one of the things that you'd want to talk about. And it is. I mean, look, you've been, I have to say, you've been all over this for a long, long time. This is happening exactly the way you've been saying it was going to happen for 2 or 3 years. So kudos to you for nailing that, because it wasn't as obvious as it appears now. You know, when you look at it now, it's everyone's saying, well, yeah, of course, this is the way it's going to go. But when you started talking about this, everybody was pushing back against you. So it does feel that's the way. And what's happening now amidst COVID obviously just hastens the process, because suddenly there are an awful lot of weak gazelles hanging off the back of the pack that are going to be very, very easy for the Lions to pick off. And, you know, they're going to take their time. And in fact, the way it looks with this particular Redbird SPAC, there may be so many weak ones hanging off the pack that you can actually go for the pack now and start picking off the healthy ones. So yeah, look, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think that was a huge story, and one that I know we'll be talking about. We have to see if we can get Jerry to come back on, if he would, and talk us through it, because it is fascinating.
But see, you know, the thing that I'm very pleased that it's you and I discussing this and what's happened with, you know, the famous, you know, six club breakaway, or whether it's the pay-per-view 1495, or whether it's the Spanish Man City chief executive saying there's no need for the football pyramid and let us play our cult teams, is that I know that you are a true sports person, in the sense that your values are correct, the way that you follow the sport is correct, you follow what would be one of the teams that would probably suffer from the new plan that's been promoted by the Big Six. I'd like to talk to you about this, because, you know, when I was involved at the end of the 90s in the breakaway of the Scottish Premier League, which was just a copy of the English one in 1992, we got labelled by the sports hacks up there as the greed is good league. So it's been 20 odd years I've heard this, sport is about more than greed, this can't be right. So I want you to tell me, without any agenda, without, you know, wanting to jump down your throat and say you're wrong, how do you assess what's happened in the last 3 or 4 days, and how does it make you feel as what I would call a proper fan of a club like Fulham?
Well, I'm also a pragmatist, Rog, so I understand why it's happening now, right? There's an opportunity here, and what we're talking about is business, and when businessmen see an opportunity, they are going to go and try and take advantage of that, period. And you know, you and I have had this conversation, and on many different levels and about many different aspects of sport, and I am the romantic, and you're always the guy who slaps around the head and says, yeah, that's great, but this is business.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I read it, and I, you know, the particularly the Project Big Picture, which I steered clear of, thinking that was going to be one for you this week. And for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, Project Big Picture is essentially a plan by the so-called Big Six in the English Premier League to basically grab just about every possible piece of power they possibly can in that league and relegate the lesser clubs to a largely passive role. But there was a sense of inevitability about it, and maybe that is because I'm a pragmatist, and maybe that is because I understand the state of the world at the moment and the fragility of the finances of the world. It had a sense of inevitability to me, and I think probably if I put the fan aside and realize that, to your point, Fulham have been struggling my entire life, Rod, so that won't make any difference. But if you put the fan aside, you realize that you're at a point where the choice is, do you allow something like this to happen? And whether it's this or something like it, I don't know. Or do you allow dozens, if not scores, of clubs go to the wall? And that really is what we're faced with here. You know, I remember years ago when Greg Norman was talking about a breakaway world golf tour. You know, he was absolutely outcast for this. Just completely, the authorities, everybody just kind of, he very much became the Kerry Packer of golf for a while. And sure enough, within a decade, the PGA Tour had started their own, you know, golf breakaway league. So, you know, with the World Golf Tour. And so these things have a tendency to happen, and the conditions are ripe now for them to happen quickly and painlessly. And I use that word in the way that I mean it, and with, yeah, with massive inverted commas around it. I think if this conversation had come up in the normal course of business, Rog, it would have been a whole different reaction to it. I think this time around, there is going to be a sense of inevitability, a sense of it being a rescue. And I think as we go forward with this, you are going to see that's exactly how this is couched. Everything you read, the talking points from the PR guys are all going to be how this could be the savior of football, this plan. You know, well, it's not going to be about that, what Grant, it does for the top clubs.
You say that the initial reaction from what I would call the great and the good of the thought leaders in English football, whether that's a Henry Winter or a Dan Rowan or all the people, their original reaction is, oh my, this greed,
no,
is, greed
I,
is
I've
good.
Seen it. I've read all those.
No,
hang on. There's two different things here, right?
Right.
There's the reaction of the commentators whose job it is to sit there, take the news and offer comment on it, right?
Yeah.
And then there is the reaction, which is far more important in the scheme of things, of the fans, who are the ones who are going to have a much louder voice than Henry Winter or Jonathan Liu or any of these guys, right?
Yeah.
And if the choice put to them is, you've got this proposal here from the big leagues, or you're out of business and the club goes into bankruptcy, what do you think is going to happen? So I appreciate, and I think all the points that the Winters of the world made, and I read all those articles, were spot on. There was very little I could find in there to even mildly disagree with. But ultimately, what this comes down to is the fans' choice. You know, think about Sunderland Till I Die, another thing that we've spoken about on this podcast before, Rog. Fantastic series. Series one, superb. And at the end of series one, they get relegated. And as the thing ends, all the fans are just miserable, and the manager's awful, the owners are awful, the players are awful. This is terrible. This is, oh my God. We wait 6 months. We get the first episode of season two, which is, you know, right before the first game of the season, and all the fans are like, can't wait for the season to get started, can't wait, this is, you know, we've missed it. Do you honestly think that given the choice of this or the club going away, which right now is not just a veiled threat, is but a very clear reality to the people who've lost their jobs in a lot of these towns, do you honestly think they're going to put up a fight?
Well, hang on a minute. Your point, your principle is correct, but I think you have to analyze a little bit the various stakeholders here. I keep coming back to that word stakeholders, because that's the secret of everything these days, to work out everybody's personal agenda. There are two or three constituents here. There are the big clubs, the Hollywood clubs that want to do the mini Disneys, as Josh Walsh calls them.
The Fulhams of the world, you mean?
No. The Fulhams of the world are in the second group, which are currently in the land of milk and honey called the Premiership. And they get to lord it over a whole lot of other clubs in the world that are bigger than them, but just don't happen to be in the geographical postcode that they are in England. I'm talking about my club, I'm talking about Ajax, Anderlecht, the usual ones. And this is the thing that gets me a little bit. The third constituency, by the way, is the EFL clubs, who are the ones you're talking about, which they are, you know, facing the abyss. So this is the thing that gets me a little bit, Grant. 20 years ago, when the big five leagues made the equivalent power play, today we talk about the big six clubs, but it was the same principle with the big five leagues that were running away with all the football money and all the football heritage and changing the Champions League so they had four guaranteed participants. The Henry Winters and the Jonathan Lewis said fuck all, Grant, because it never affected them. You know, But those of us in Scotland and Holland and Portugal and in Belgium and Turkey and Greece and Yugoslavia, as it was then, we all knew that this was happening. So there's a little bit of me that says, you see, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. Leave that aside, because that's what some people might consider my little bitterness about what I lived through personally. The second thing I would say is this, and this is super important. I think there's maybe 10, a dozen guys like me that have lived the internal workings of a football league when this shit is going down, you know? Breakaways, you know, here you've got six clubs negotiating with the EFL, Rick Parry, behind the back of their league, the Premiership, and the Premiership coming out saying it's disgusted and disappointed and everything like that. That's civil war, right? Now, I've lived that, you know, and one of the things that people will take out of this has been the genius of Richard Scudamore. You know, when you are in charge of a league, it's not about can you maximize sponsorships, can you maximize your TV deal. It's about keeping your clubs pointing more or less in the same direction without them freaking out. And that was the genius of Richard Scudamore. He got all 20. You never heard anybody complaining. We all knew that nobody was happy with the equal share of the overseas rights. He managed that, made it a small issue that maybe was around for half a day, then disappeared. He leaves, and within X months, 6 months, whatever it is, of him leaving, look what we've got. Look what we've got.
Well, yeah, but look, I mean, there's a big asterisk over that, Roger, in terms of look what we've got, right? Look what's happened in those 6 months to the world.
As I say, I just think that's Franz Ferdinand. That's just the catalyst, Grant. It was all there.
Oh no, I don't disagree with that. I don't disagree with that. But the fact that the catalyst happened, it could have happened 2 years after Scudamore left, right? I just think that timing of the Scudamore thing, that's just timing, nothing more than timing. I don't disagree with you. I think this was inevitable, because they're all trying to chase more and more money. They're all trying to grow their profits, et cetera, et cetera. This was inevitable. I totally agree with you. But had it been kind of put forward not against the threat of extinction, it would have been fought a lot harder this time around. Because what's the alternative? The alternative to a proposal like this, I'm not saying it's actually this one that ultimately breaks this thing apart, but the alternative to a proposal like this is what? There's only one, and that's government bailouts. And if you think there's any way the governments are going to be able to bail out every football club in England when there is a multi-hundred million dollar offer on the table, there's not a chance for us. How can they possibly do that? We're going to pay hundreds of millions of taxpayer money because the fans don't want the $250 million on offer from the Americans and the Qataris. Forget it.
Grant, I think I hear you. I just, you know, I look at today and yesterday, and I see the hammering that Rick Parry is getting, the chairman of the English Football League. You know, I know Rick very well. He was the CEO of the English Premiership when I joined in Scotland, and I went down to say to him, what do I need to do here? How does it work? And he was very generous with his time. A lot of people don't like Rick. A lot of people don't like his reputation, his personality. He got a very hard time for what was called in a couple of biographies, bending over and being seduced by the Murdochs to take their deal as opposed to the ITV deal, which I think turned out that Rick probably was right to go to back-to-back Sky and bet on Sky. So he's now coming out as this horrible double dealer who, shock horror, used to be the chief exec of Liverpool. So he's right in with them, isn't he? It's almost, you know, like they're kind of like conniving together. He used to be the chief exec of the English Premiership. He should know better. How dare he? Here's the reality, Grant, if I may. He goes into an organization as chairman and says, what future does my organization have? What is the vision for the EFL? What structural problems does the EFL have? Well, the main one is that everybody tries to get into the Premiership and spend too much. and it becomes a bit of a financial basket case. Secondly, with the parachute payments, you get yo-yo clubs because the chasm is too big. He talked about that in the last couple of days. So what does he do as a pro in charge and being paid to run an organisation that had significant threats to its existence? He tries to make alliances. So he knows what he has to try and do. He goes to the bigger clubs and says, apparently it's quoted in The Athletic that he went to them and said, look, if the Premiership don't play ball, if you don't get your famous 14 votes for this, just break away and join the EFL. I mean, can you conceive that, Grant? You know, like what I'm saying is Rick is getting criticised for doing what any proper business person would do to try and look after the interests of his member clubs. And he is making an alliance with other people who want those similar objectives, the top six clubs, and the losers are the bottom half of the Premiership. So be it. This comes back to my previous point. The bottom half of the Premiership, the Palaces, the West Broms, the Fulhams, if I can, all of them, when they were trousering $120 million a year in TV money, never had a thought for, you know, the glory of a Benfica or an Ajax. Now they feel the steel, the cold steel of the same sword.
Yeah, Roger, look, I don't disagree with you. I'm putting aside what I think is right and wrong for the game and being pragmatic about it, because the game is under threat. It's that simple. And so I think this or something like it will happen. The horse is absolutely out of the barn now. So I don't know what it's going to look like. And people can pick holes in the Rick Parrys of the world, but the way these deals tend to happen is, you know, this thing gets put forward, it's a huge shock, and then it becomes a discussion point, and then somehow over time the reaction to it in the press has softened a little bit to the point where it can get passed. That's just the way these things go. And so, you know, I suspect this will happen sooner rather than later now, simply because of the massive pressure that the clubs who are going to have to concede points to this are under now.
Well, what do you think about, apart from structures and winners and losers, what do you think about what I think has been a tactical error that obviously they didn't expect this story to be leaked or come out in the Telegraph, but the other things that do give credence to the greed is good type criticism, the pay-per-view, 1495, the Man City people saying to hell with the pyramid system, forgetting that club was there themselves not so long ago in Division 2 or whatever it was called at that time.
Yeah.
There is, you know, everything these days goes along narrative. You and I talk about this a lot also in our day jobs. There is a narrative that football is full of greed. You know, we saw this week again, you know, the agent story come up. You know, Gary Lineker being very vocal about agents. You know, there's a whole smell of greed is good. It's been taken away from the fan. It'll go to big corporate, big money. That's why I think that this isn't a done deal now. You know, you say it's inevitable. As I'm saying, I know how these things go. The politics and the backbiting and the smoke-filled room, maybe less so now, the smoke-filled rooms of decisions are a long, long way to run. And what I think this will lead to will be a period of paralysis where everybody and their wife will have, or husband, will have an opinion. Everybody will want to be seen to be virtue signalling along the right lines. Nothing will get done. Clubs in the EFL will start toppling over. And I think we'll be here in 2021 still talking about what is the future structure of European football.
Look, it's possible. And I've learned over the years to trust your gut on issues like this way more than mine. But I just think the pressure that these guys are under, there's no alternative but to do something now. The status quo just can't continue. And I think, to address the points you made there, yes, I think the pay-per-view thing was absolutely ridiculous. I mean, that's just pure greed. I mean, that was outrageous, the sort of numbers they were talking there. I mean, I was really shocked when I saw that, I have to say. I mean, does it? I'm shocked but not surprised, if that makes sense, Rog. But I think I just think that if there's a period of paralysis, then those clubs that are going to topple, as you described it, are going to start toppling quickly, and so that will likely end the paralysis quicker than you may think. I don't know, but I think all of these. Listening to that last soliloquy of yours there, on the one hand, I can feel the kind of opportunism. And the worries about the big clubs, the big business, and all this side. On the other side of it, you know, the first goal of the week was a SPAC taking over Fenway Sports Group in Liverpool for $8 billion. So business is here. It's here, I would say, hopefully, to stay, because without it, who knows? You know, unless you get what we talked about before, which is a complete and utter ripping up of everything, and an installation of salary caps and players' salaries getting slashed to the bone, et cetera, et cetera. Unless those kind of things happen to address the greed, which you've identified as the big problem, I don't see any way that the greed gets defeated, sadly, Rog.
Yeah. Just to lighten that a little bit, you mentioned the SPAC again. Remember that story I told in a previous podcast about the meeting I had with the Celtic CEO, and he asked me about Damien Duff. And since I played Football Manager, I was able to give him a good... You remember that?
Yeah.
So, Jerry Cardinale's Redbird bought Toulouse, the French club that's just been relegated, and we had a wonderful discussion about that with Jerry. The man in charge of that club now is Damien Comolli, who may be well known to listeners, especially around Tottenham, and he's been a football director of football in the English game for a while now. Damien came out this week with this quote: "We will be doing our transfer dealings using Football Manager."
No way!
I'm telling you, here's an article here. There's quotes.
That's hilarious.
Well, listen, people again will know that the scouting that is performed by Football Manager is to such a level of expertise and detail that I'm not saying that as a criticism of Comolli. I'm saying that is, again, the reality. Football Manager is really, really good for that. But it just goes to show you, you know, like, I think all we can say about this whole segment is that, as somebody says, may you live in interesting times.
You saw that talking of this kind of stuff. You saw that story I posted on Twitter about Burger King sponsoring.
Yes.
Is it Stevenage Town? Right,
Stevenage. Yeah.
I mean, that was genius. It was absolutely genius. For those of you that haven't seen it, if you Google Burger King Stevenage Town, they sponsored Stevenage Town, which is a very lower league soccer team in the UK, put their logo on their shirt, and Stevenage Town got into FIFA.
Yeah, I think it's FIFA.
Which is again FIFA.
Yeah.
And as the popularity in FIFA rose, people were putting, you know, the Messis of the world, the Suarez of the world into their Stevenage team. And the return for Burger King in terms of how many people were playing with the Stevenage Town logo on their chest, how many people were seeing it, was remarkable. It's just a fantastic story. And I would urge you to Google that, Burger King and Stevenage Town. It's just, I can't do it justice here. Watching the video for 5 minutes will tell the story in all its glory. It's fantastic.
Yeah. I've still got an own goal, is it? I've still got? Is that right?
Well, you can have whatever you like, Roger. You can have whatever you like.
Yeah,
I've got a couple of little stories that I want to talk about.
No rush, mate. My own goal comes pointed to us by our wonderful producer, James Gibb, which was the glorious madness around the Formula 4 race.
Ah, yes.
This is a track. I know somebody, I play golf with somebody who drives fast cars. He's a rich guy. And he knows these people well. So the story was, if MD didn't see it, a chap going around gets pushed off on a go-karting race. waits where he's been pushed off with his bumper in his hand. And when the guy that pushed him off comes around again, throws it at him, throws a bumper, a big bumper at him. It hits him and probably the two drivers behind him, and then walks over the racetrack, causing danger to everybody. Doesn't end there. When the race is over and they're all in the kind of like area where all the cars are packed, he starts what you would call in Glasgow a world-class stushy with the guy that pushed them off, and they're really going at it big time. And the father of this chap, the Italian driver who owns the track, comes in heavy, and you know, it becomes a mass brawl. I said to this guy, a golfer, I said, look, what's the lot about? He said, oh, yeah. Crazy, because this is one of the most profitable tracks in Europe, especially in the winter months. Everybody comes down to the track. It's called, place in Lake Garda, there. And, you know, so they made the apologies immediately. The son racer said, I don't want to race again. Take my license away. I have to be, you know, in ash cloth and feathers for the rest of my life. Father said the same, but they have suspended the licenses from all three. Me personally, I've never seen anything as dangerous in the sporting field as what that guy did, Grant.
Yeah, no, I saw it. I say James did flag that to us. I mean, I couldn't believe what I was watching, frankly. I mean, it was just extraordinary. And then you see, you know, spoilt kid, son of the track owner, feeding into the story. But not even someone, but people could have been, if not badly injured, then killed by what he did. And you just wonder, Raj, at someone who could do something like that. I lost track of what happened after, so I'm delighted that he actually, at least he's said, take my license away.
And, yes, he said he doesn't want to race ever again. He's ashamed. I tend to think that's pragmatism of the old man saying, you realise that this course generates this family X, and if you don't take the fall for this, we're all going down. I tend to think that's the reality of it. Business talks, but interesting that whole area of NASCAR, you know, and that kind of like what we would call non-Formula One secondary type racing. You know, your mate Michael Jordan bought a NASCAR team with Bubba Wallace. You know, and the interesting thing they're saying is that they want to change the multicultural demographic of NASCAR, which what it means is they want to make it more black. So Michael Jordan's bought it. This Bubba Wallace is a top black driver. George Pine, who's coming on our podcast and has made his name in NASCAR, he's also an investor. So the world of motorsport is definitely changing. And, you know, some things you see are good and some things you see are very parochial and quite depressing.
Well, I think that goes much wider than motorsport, sadly, Rog.
Yeah.
Well, look, let me. I've got a couple of other little things that I may not want to talk about. First was Game 5 of the NBA Finals between the Los Angeles Lakers and the Miami Heat. Now, I've had taken zero interest in the restarted NBA. I'll be the first to admit. It just hasn't interested me. It's just not something that I... And I'm a huge basketball fan, as you know. But I tuned into the fourth quarter of Game 5, and the Miami Heat, who were certainly the underdogs, and they ended up losing the final game last night, to witness LeBron James and Miami's Jimmy Butler basically going at each other for the last 5 minutes of the fourth quarter, Miami prevailing ultimately, but it was just a fantastic duel between two guys at the very top of their game. Neither one of them willing to back down. Neither one of them willing to let their team lose. You know, and with all the crap that goes on, again, that was for me was another perfect example of what's good about sport. You know, competition at the highest level, heart, soul, athletic ability. It was just tremendous to watch.
Yeah. You know, when we talked about the Last Dance, when we talked about what drives these world class performers, not just athletes, it is often the rivalry or being challenged by somebody, and they get an extra motivation to slap the young pretender down. You know, so I hear you, Grant. I want to link that a little bit. I hadn't thought about this for today's show, but it reminds me now. Did you see Patrick Evra talking about
the United? Oh, Man United.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that was intense, wasn't it?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
same
yeah.
kind of thing. You know, like, this isn't what we do. You know, and you know, I that's the stuff that I love in sport. It's the testosterone of the world, or that can be for a woman as well, you know, like a Serena Williams or something like that. When they're really under the gun, they just find some kind of drive that comes from their total obsession with being number one that does that kind of thing. So that what you say, I recognize. And I think that when you look at some of the underperforming football teams around, it's they just don't have anybody with those kind of profiles. You know, Man United, first of all, I can't think of anybody that would live with the teams of the Pallisters, the Bruce, the Keens, the Brian Robsons, you know, and Evra obviously was part of that. I think it's one of the huge things in sport, the eye of the tiger type thing that you can witness us not having it.
Well, what I found interesting about that, Rog, was, and you know, Evra and then, you know, Gary Neville, just apoplectic about what they'd seen, and an awful lot of discussion in the press for the next week or so about Woodward and United being all at sea and directors of football and all this sort of stuff. And yet the day after it, Liverpool get thumped 7-2 by Aston Villa, and it's an off day. You know what I mean? It's. I didn't see the hand wringing, and yes, of course, Liverpool have won
big
everything.
Big difference, no.
Of course, but my point is, it's United aren't getting thumped 6-1 every week. They got thumped 6-1.
They are metaphorically, Grant.
Well, they are. Right, you could argue that, but still, I just found it interesting.
United. They haven't been United for 10 years. I agree with that.
No, they're certainly not Fergie's United. That is for sure. And you're right.
That's the answer. They've got no. No, it is.
But I just found it very interesting that just you would think that in the discussions of the Man United result, people would be bringing the Liverpool result into it. But no, it's almost as if that Villa victory didn't happen. You know what I mean? It was Villa got no credit for it, and. The reality of the game, because I watched it, was they absolutely tore Liverpool apart. They got no credit for it at all, and Liverpool wasn't really brought up. I mean, I've read nothing about that game. It's amazing.
Yeah, well, the answer is the one that you gave yourself, Grant. There's nobody can see the program, the plan at Man United. There's a clear plan at Liverpool. They just had a bad day at the office, which can happen to anybody. Man United don't have a plan.
Well,
to everybody. And they've got nobody that's on that field that's going to lead those young men when it's a difficult time. Nobody. Maguire as a captain is absolutely in the wrong movie, apart from the fact that he's a dreadful defender as well. De Gea, you know, could possibly win that person, but he's lost all confidence. And then you look around that team and they're all little, you know, good players, but none of them are what I would call a personality. An Eric Cantona, yeah. Brian Robson. Stevie
There's
Bruce.
No Roy Keane in that team, that's for sure.
You know, I always believe that when I try and bet on football matches, I just count up the number of inverted commas leaders on both sides. And the one that's got most leaders is usually who I bet on. It's a really good correlation. Just, you know, you think about that. And Man United don't have any. Tottenham don't really have any. It works really well as a leading indicator.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough. I'll pay more attention to that in future. Well, come on, you said you had one more. What was it?
I wanted to. We mentioned a couple of times before the strategy of Apple in sports and content. I don't know whether we want to get into it or not, but you got me on to subscribing to Apple Plus to see Ted Lasso, which I saw. And then I watched, more interestingly for me, I watched the morning show as well. And I think there's a couple of, especially the morning show, a couple of themes in there that I found quite interesting before getting into the old Me Too stuff. I really enjoyed the idea that, you know, sometimes things need freshened up. Morning show's about an old duo of presenting morning television. One of them has to go because of a sexual scandal, and they have to replace it, and then they think about how to replace it and how to appeal to new audiences and how to shake things up. And the person that gets it is edgy, raw, not sophisticated, not the kind of anchor person that you would find in most of the networks, but she is, quotes, authentic. And it just comes back to what I was saying a little bit before. I think that's where content is now. You know, I won't go in again to my favourite Barstool type comparisons, but honestly, that's what people want now. They have no time for the smooth PR media trained, let's not offend everybody. They just want somebody to have a rock and roll. And I thought Morning Show is many much more deeper themes than one I've just mentioned, mainly around Me Too. And I was surprised at my own reaction as how I watched that. It went from both sides of the spectrum. I thought it was done really, really well. So I can see why that got all the awards. Ted Lasso, as I said to you after I watched the first 10 minutes, I thought this is going to be really great because this is a new owner coming into a football club and having to deal with all the old dinosaurs, you know, the not invented here people. We don't do it this way. Don't you understand all that? And instead it went into a more rom-com type, quite entertaining, but not too hard hitting, bubblegum type. That's what I thought, you know. So, you know, for Apple Plus, I watched Ted Lasso because you told me to. I watched it all the way through. It was nice. It wasn't rubbish, but it wasn't anything great for me. Morning Show I thought was outstanding, and I've currently cancelled my subscription after watching those two shows.
Well, there you go. That's the Scotsman in you, obviously. You probably had another couple of weeks, didn't you, of free subscription?
I do. No.
You don't want to take the chance.
No, I give you 1 week. 1 week free subscription.
Oh, that's all it is. Okay.
And I hadn't finished Ted Lasso and I hadn't even started Morning Show. But once I did, I looked at the other fare around there and I thought, that's nowhere near good enough, mister.
No, I agree. I got my subscription because my Apple TV went on the fritz. So I had to buy a new one. I got a free year with it. There's nowhere near enough content on there yet, but it'd be interesting to see what they do. I suspect that's a conversation for another day, Ross.
Yeah, it is.
It'll be much deeper. I really enjoyed Ted Lasso. I have to say, it wasn't deep, and I think it was meant to be. But I actually thought it was. I wasn't expecting much. I really enjoyed it. Anyway,
what's your last one? No, you've got one more.
I do. Oh well, no. I was just gonna give a shout out to our boy Eddie Pepperell after an excellent finish in the PGA yesterday. You know, Tyrrell Hatton ran away with the tournament, pretty much. He was pushed by Victor Perez, but I never really felt like he was in trouble for some reason. I don't know why. But, you know, Eddie had a good week last week. You know, something definitely to build on. And he ended up, I think, Poulter pipped him for fourth on his own with a putt on the last green. So a good week for Eddie. Bless him. He was playing well. It was good to see.
Did you see his comment, which he tweeted, as he always does, about Bryson? You may not have seen it. He, you know, in Eddie's way, he said, I've worked out, you know, what Bryson's all about. He's just speeded up his swing. And then he makes a comment and saying, that's all very well, but you can't do that with the technical sides of a swing. It certainly doesn't work. So he was alluding to the fact, I think, that people with a technical type swing like himself can't do what Bryson has done, which is basically take what looks like a very basic and elegant swing and just like juice it up and speed it up to get more power. That was the gist of what I think.
Yeah, I did see this tweet. I mean, what DeChambeau's done is gone back to a guy called Mo Norman, who was a Canadian golfer who many pros in the 60s would have said was one of, if not the best golfers in the world. And he was around the time of the Nicholas Trevinos of the world. He played in the US a couple of times, but had this very unusual swing, which was on one plane, and he would start the club 8 inches behind the ball on his backswing, and he had all kinds of quirks in his swing, but he was purported to be the most accurate drive of a golf ball who's ever lived. And a lot of the pros at that time, the Trevinos of the world, are on record as saying that Mo Norman was the greatest golfer they'd ever seen. And there was a podcast recently, actually. I think it was either a Golf Digest or a Golf World podcast, all about Mo Norman. And it's a fantastic story. And some of the there was a guy who knew him up in Canada, who played with him, and he tells this great story that they were playing this course. There was a par five, a big dogleg, right angle, and on the all down the right hand side with this massive trees. And so the guy tees off, you know, straight down the fairway. Mo aims his drive into the trees and just blasts his driver straight over the trees into the woods. And the guy's like, "What are you doing?" They walk through the woods, and he says, "There was a patch of grass 20 yards wide by 20 yards long in the middle of that wood, and that's where his ball was, and he had a wedge to the green." So supposedly this guy could hit the ball exactly where he wanted it every time because he had this very simple swing. And that's really what Bryson's done. He's gone back to that swing. If you look at how he does it, you know, all his clubs are the same length, all the shafts of his clubs are the same length, his arms are very straight when he putts. He's taken as many variables out of it as he can. And yes, that does give him the ability to speed it up, because he's removed a lot of the kind of wrist hinges and things that could potentially, if they're out of sync, cause you to spray the ball over the place. I mean, more interesting were Matt Fitzpatrick's comments about DeChambeau taking all the fun out of golf. He said those, and they came out when he was sitting on the lead on Friday night at the PGA, and he went out the next day and had just a dreadful round. Poor guy, couldn't get anything to fall, and he was clearly very agitated. So, the DeChambeau story is an interesting one, and it's just getting started. We haven't seen the DeChambeau mimics yet, but no doubt we're going to see plenty of them coming through, Roger.
Yeah, but listen, that's great input. I mean, like, fantastic. Given that, I think Eddie's point is very, very interesting, because that I've started taking up golf again, and you know the teacher.
Yeah, we should probably talk about that at some point.
that's you. That's you.
El Bandido.
Yeah, if you give me a 28 handicap, that's what's going to happen. But anyway, that's not the point. So the coach that I've never had any lessons, the coach said, you know, like, it's much more, you have to use your hands. It is the wrists and everything like that. And you know, I'm very excited by that, because I can see that when you do that, it's a completely different ball striking, completely different. So if you're saying that he's just removing all that and just swinging like some kind of like lumberjack, that is not a good thing for golf. The beautiful thing about golf is that some people are able to hit shots that look very, very strange because they use their hands in a very specific way. I now understand much better Eddie's tweet, and that's fascinating, Grant.
But look, there's 6 inches of the golf swing that matter, right? And that's the four before you hit the ball and the two after you hit it. As long as the club face is in a certain position during that little part of the golf swing, it doesn't matter what you do in between. And the wrist is really to generate more speed, right? You're gonna rip your wrist. So if Bryson can take the wrist out of it and generate more speed, it's a variable that, you know, when you think about what you have to do with your wrist, the odds of getting it right are
It's very difficult
very
to get the timing.
So anyway, no doubt we can talk about this another time, Rog, because I think we're just about out of time.
I think we're done. I think we're done. The craziness of sport, the craziness of the world. I would like to say, when we talk about breakaways and new leagues and super leagues and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, there's that wonderful, wonderful Chinese proverb, which is, if you sit by the edge of the river long enough on the bank, you'll see the dead body floating by. I had all this stuff in 1998, and we're now 22 years later, and it's all floating by.
And you're just sat on the riverside watching it.
I'm on the lakeside, as in the lake,
there
watching
you go.
It.
As in the lake. Well, all that remains, I guess, is to thank you out there for listening to this. Otherwise, it would just be like Statler and Waldorf in the balcony of the Muppet Show complaining at each other. So thanks for listening. Do take a moment, if you have the chance, to rate and review us on iTunes. It takes a couple of seconds, and it really does help. You can follow us in the meantime on Twitter. You'll find us at EntertainedR, that's the word, A-R-E. You can find me at TTMYGH.
And you can find myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake, or by the lake this week.
Yes.
Either way.
Either way.
Rog, always a pleasure, my friend.
No, thank you.
We'll talk soon.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.